Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by DUPACO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken, sitting down here in going to be pretty warm Missouri, reading, though, from the Friday, March 15th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we begin with our first piece from the top of the fold on page one. Leaders pitch city priorities at D.C. fly-in. From Washington, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican, Iowa, left a meeting with Dubuque city and business leaders at the U.S. Capitol on Thursday with a clear sense of the local officials' top priorities for federal lawmakers. First and foremost, they said the first, second, and third priority for them is air service, Ernst said following the meeting. A delegation of city government, business, and nonprofit leaders brought their top needs to federal officials at the nation's capital this week during Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce's D.C. fly-in. The group spent 2 days meeting with members of the area's congressional delegation and with staff from federal agencies, wrapping up their visit Thursday. Our goal is to build a better Dubuque, and our vision is to do it through people, planning, and partnerships. And that's what we represented in D.C., said Terry Hawks Goodman, the City of Dubuque's Director of Strategic Partnerships. At the top of the Dubuque delegation's priority list was reinforcing to federal lawmakers and agencies the importance of restoring daily commercial air service to Dubuque after American Airlines halted service to Dubuque Regional Airport in September 2022. Local leaders have been working since then to return daily air service to Dubuque, efforts that have yielded, among other things, a $1.5 million federal Small Community Air Service Development Program grant that officials can use to help attract a new carrier. Air service is a high priority for all the organizations and governmental agencies in Dubuque, City, County, Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, the Chamber, Travel Dubuque, said Dubuque Airport Director Todd Dalsing. While city and chamber leaders have been advocating to federal lawmakers as they seek to bring additional air service to the community, there's nothing that replaces a face-to-face meeting with legislators, said Molly Grover, president and CEO of the Dubuque Chamber. Making this trip a priority says way more than a phone call or a letter ever could. And they heard loud and clear, there's no doubt that air service is indeed the number one priority, and that we are going to continue to work every angle until we are successful in achieving that goal, she said. Among the Dubuque delegation's meetings was a stop at the office of U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican, Iowa. Hinson noted afterward that her office has worked to connect local leaders with airline officials and worked on additional funding opportunities, such as the grant the Dubuque Airport received. Hinson said she was impressed by the broad coalition the Dubuque community has built around support for air service. It is amazing to see a community come together in this way, and I almost would say it's unprecedented to see so many people working this well together on an issue that everybody is so passionate about, she said. While air service was top of mind for attendees of the D.C. fly-in, they also made sure to highlight other priorities to federal lawmakers, such as the protection and enhancement of historic tax credits, immigration reform to help bolster the workforce, and support for the city's grant applications. It's important that we have a realistic and effective immigration system in the United States so that people can immigrate to this country and become a part of the workforce, Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said. I think that somehow we need to figure out a way to have an actually effective immigration policy in the United States, and that will take congressional action. The trip also came with some positive news in an announcement from U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican, Iowa, which noted that the City of Dubuque and East Central Intergovernmental Association had been awarded a $2 million grant to support a future phase of the city's smart traffic routing with efficient and effective traffic signals, or STREETS, project, which seeks to develop a smart traffic management system for the city. The first phase of the project has focused on developing technology for signals and signage on major corridors to manage traffic more efficiently. That phase is expected to begin rolling out this year. The latest grant will be used to help develop an open cellular vehicle to everything, or CV2X interface. The technology uses transportation information to detect hazards, reduce traffic congestion, and alert drivers to collision trajectories in near real time, according to a news release. Assistant City Engineer Bob Schiesel noted that he learned about the grant just before their meeting with Grassley on Thursday morning. "It was a really nice opportunity to celebrate with Senator Grassley and his staff because it's such an important component to be able to get the funding to keep advancing this state-of-the-art project," Schiesel said. Grassley said following his meeting with the local delegation that he was pleased to announce to the group their receipt of the grant. He also noted the value of opportunities, such as the fly-in, that highlight what is most important to communities. "When we get people that are together in their own community, and that means people of all political persuasions, different businesses, civic leaders, you come out unified, and it makes our job a lot easier," he said. Our next front page piece: changes could impact tax filing. With 1 month left until the federal tax filing deadline, it's officially crunch time for tri-state taxpayers. The federal personnel income tax filing deadline is set for April 15th. This year. That deadline is the same for both Wisconsin and Illinois tax filings, although Iowans have until the end of April to file their state income tax return. While much about those filings remains the same year over year, tri-state area experts attest there are some new changes and considerations for this year's taxpayers. In Iowa, for example, this tax season marks the first where the state will not tax retirement income after the passage of a 2022 state law that went into effect with retirement income earned after January 1, 2023. That's any retirement income, whether it be Social Security, a 401k, or an IRA. None of that is taxable in the state of Iowa for anyone over the age of 55, explained Larry Zettel, a local volunteer with the IRS Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. "For a lot of retired people, that means they're going to be paying less in taxes." VITA is a no-cost tax service geared toward residents who generally make $64,000 per year or less, residents with disabilities, and those who speak limited English. It's available through HACAP in Dubuque, Delaware, and Jackson counties. Another change for Iowa taxpayers this year is the move to adopt the federal standard deduction for state income taxes instead of having Iowa-specific deductions, said Linda Goldsmith, tax preparer at Affordable Tax Service in Dubuque. A deduction refers to the amount an individual is able to subtract or deduct from their taxable income when filing their personal income taxes. Standard deductions are flat rates based on filing status, while itemized deductions are the combination of all tax-deductible expenditures made during that tax year. The rule of thumb is to pick whichever is higher, Goldsmith said, to lower your overall tax bill. The standard deduction in Iowa now matches the federal deduction of $13,850 for single filers and $27,700 for married couples filing jointly. That's compared to state-specific deductions of $2,210 and $5,450 last year, respectively. Given the jump, Goldsmith said, fewer Iowa taxpayers need to itemize their deductions since it's unlikely they'd exceed the flat rate of the new standard deduction. We have clients who are used to lugging in all these documents and receipts to add up their itemized deductions. And for a lot of them, that's just not necessary anymore, she said. That's a big change for some folks. The shift has saved time for area taxpayers, Goldsmith added, as well as their tax professionals. It saves us at least 30 minutes per person not to have to go through all those itemized deductions, she said. It doesn't seem like a lot, but it can seem a lot longer when you have a client sitting across the table waiting. Not much has changed this year in the way of individual filings for Wisconsin residents, said Stacy Lull, co-owner of Accounting and Tax Solutions, Inc. in Lancaster, Wisconsin, marking a return to relatively normalcy after years of pandemic-related disruptions. She said some homeowners, however, stand to benefit from the expansion of home energy tax credits backed by the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. Under the federal program, individuals who make energy improvements to their homes in any state in the U.S. are eligible to receive tax credits for a portion of qualifying expenses. For improvements made in 2023, the credit equals up to 30% of qualifying expenses, up to a maximum of $1,200. For improvements made in 2022, the maximum credit was only $500. That's something to think about if you've been doing some home improvement projects around efficiency, Lull said. Really, anyone who owns their own home could benefit. Several new or expanded tax credits also are available for Illinois residents. Eligible Illinois emergency volunteers can now receive a $500 non-refundable income tax credit, for example, and qualified educators can receive up to a $500 credit for the purchase of classroom materials and supplies. Also, many tri-state area residents now can file their federal taxes for free using the IRS Free File program. Anyone whose adjusted gross income is $79,000 or less can use the Guided Tax software, which is one of the services the IRS partners with to help residents file federal taxes at no cost. Free fill-in-the-blank forms are available to anyone whose gross income exceeds $79,000. Similar income-based programs are available at the state level for residents in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. Whichever means an individual uses to file their taxes, however, area experts are recommending local residents make haste as the federal deadline approaches. That deadline is coming up, Goldsmith warned. You don't want to wait and walk into our office on April 15th. Our final piece is called River Refuge, marking 100 years, and with it comes a huge picture, a long shot picture, overlooking a beautiful blue-colored Mississippi River and the sky in the background. And beneath it, we have the caption, Horseshoe Bluff in the Mines of Spain State Recreation Area along the Mississippi River on Thursday. This stretch of the river is located in the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge's Savannah District. The Refuge will celebrate its 100th anniversary on June 7th. And our article is, it was the early 1920s, and the recently established Isaac Walton League, a group of Midwestern anglers and outdoor enthusiasts, were aghast at the conditions of the Mississippi River floodplain. Backwaters and wetlands were being drained to make way for industries like farming and logging. Surface water was rapidly becoming polluted, and fish were dying. So the members of the Isaac Walton League, named for the 17th century conservationist, angler, and author, approached the U.S. Congress with a plea to protect the river they loved. On June 7, 1924, Congress passed the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge Act, which authorized the acquisition of land for a refuge between Rock Island, Illinois, and Wabasha, Minnesota. A century later, the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge stretches 261 river miles and covers 240,000 square miles of Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. According to its website, the refuge hosts more than 3.7 million annual visits for hunting, fishing, wildlife observation, and other recreation. To celebrate the refuge's upcoming 100th birthday, E.B. Lyons Interpretive Center at the Mines of Spain State Recreational Area hosted a public gathering on Thursday. Around 40 people convened for a presentation from Ed Britton, manager of the refuge's Savannah District. Britton said Congress's action in 1924 helped preserve an upper Mississippi River dotted by backwater wetlands and pools that support wildlife and recreation, a scene very different from the industrialized downriver areas with their straight channels and dangerous currents. The diversity of the river's really been enhanced by the refuge, he said. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service oversees the entire Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. However, some of the land is owned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the Fish and Wildlife Service partners with many local governments and organizations to manage the area. The refuge is separated into four administrative districts, two of which converge in Dubuque at Lock and Dam No. 11. The McGregor District begins in Reno, Minnesota, and runs 110 miles south to Dubuque, where the Savannah, Illinois District picks up and continues for 80 miles down to Princeton, Iowa. Britton said the refuge is home to more than 100 species of fish, and over 300 species of birds migrate through it every year, from pelicans and tundra swans to piping plovers and bobolinks. Bald eagles can often be seen around locks and dams, such as in Dubuque and Bellevue, Iowa, where the river is frozen during the winter and the only open water to be found is near the dams. Britton said the birds have made a comeback in the refuge for over the past 50 years. In 1972, on the refuge, we had one bald eagle nest, he said. Now we're averaging 350 to 400 nests each year. Since the National Wildlife Refuge System's main priority is wildlife conservation, parts of the refuge are closed to public access during certain seasons to provide a sanctuary for migrating waterfowl. However, Britton said there are plenty of opportunities for recreation within the refuge, including birding, hunting, fishing, boating, and hiking. We have a lot of ice fishing, except not so much this year, he said, eliciting a chuckle from the audience. We have some beautiful beaches. Since COVID, we've seen so many more people out there. Managing the massive refuge has its challenges, such as drought, flooding, and erosion, all of which have been exacerbated by climate change, according to Britton. Invasive species like zebra mussels, silver carp, and burr cucumber also pose threats to native mollusks, fish, and vegetation. When these floods come up and they kill the floodplain forest, These invasive plants are like a spider web. They completely cover everything. They kill trees and nothing native comes back in, Britton said. There's many areas where all you can see is dead forest. Helping combat these issues and preserve the refuge is the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program, a coordinated effort by the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps, and the states of Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Britton said the program has funded tens of millions of dollars worth of projects like island creation, shoreline restoration, and backwater dredging to combat erosion and preserve overwintering habits for fish. We're still thriving, he said. It's a difficult time for funding in federal agencies right now, but the river is so dynamic out there. Dubuque residents Rachel Stile and Rachel Buchheit said they knew little about the refuge prior to Britton's presentation and were intrigued to learn how its history has shaped the Mississippi River and surrounding ecosystems. I thought it was neat learning about how it's a nature program that deals with conservation, not just access for humans, Stile said at Thursday night's event. The fact that they put conservation first, I think, is important. Now we'll turn to our opinion page and our view, the quick takes that represent the editorial points of view of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. And we have one frowny and two smiley faces. So we'll start with the frowny face. Thank State of Iowa for confusing county tax letter. Iowa property owners will soon be getting letters from their county officials that will detail tax levies, total revenues, and expenditures of each taxing entity per county. The form also will announce future public hearings on both the tax levy and budgets for each taxing authority in whose jurisdiction a property lies. Mandated by the state following changes to Iowa tax law last year, a letter explaining everything seems like a good thing. In reality, though, Dubuque County officials say the form property owners will receive is complicated and unlikely to provide any clarity. That's unfortunate. Here's what taxpayers opening this letter from the county want to know. How much are my taxes proposed to be? Instead, they will find a 14-page form spelling out details like the county property tax levy, $9.21 per $1,000 of taxable property value in Dubuque County. The total property tax revenue the county anticipates, $35.67 million in Dubuque County, total county revenue. $67.5 million in Dubuque County. County's expenditures, $80.6 million. How much will need to come in from reserves? $13 million. And an example of what the levies together would total per $100,000 of a property's assessed value. Even though rollbacks established by the state government determine how much of a property's assessed value is taxable. So the diligent property owner might be able to grab a calculator and run some math formulas to pencil out what their tax obligation will be. Simple, right? Actually, the county auditor said he expects some challenges due to the way the state's taxpayer information statement has been organized, as well as the county having to send said letters to every individual owner of every property. Informing property owners about the changes in the state's system is a good idea. Mailing out 2 million lengthy, confusing letters that shed little light on taxpayers' main questions is not such a good idea. It never works well when one government entity, the Iowa Department of Management, develops a plan or form for another entity, Iowa's 99 counties, to execute. Bottom line, when you get a confusing letter from the county, don't panic and don't blame the county. You'll get your regular county tax bill. Our second piece is a smiley face. Looks like Mother Nature has heard this. Is Sunshine Week and is ready to celebrate with us. Let's hear it for open access to government. Sunshine Week is a critical reminder of the need for transparency and open government at every level. While that access is the right of every citizen, it is often newspapers that champion those efforts and hold government accountable. We set aside this week in March to honor that commitment to accessible government and the public's right to know. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican, Iowa, makes a point of offering remarks on the importance of Sunshine Week each year. Quote, "To control a government as big as ours, it takes a lot of very bright light shining on every agency and office. Instead of one week called Sunshine Week, we ought to have 365 days a year in which we have sunshine on our local government's operation. We all ought to be thankful for Sunshine Week, which is an opportunity for us doing our constitutional duty of oversight to highlight these efforts and to remind us that shining a constant light is essential to making government accountable to we the people." We couldn't agree more. And our third one is also a smiley face. It's exciting to see Dubuque County bringing on state-of-the-art technology when it comes to emergency communications. Last week, the Dubuque Emergency Communications Center, which serves all of Dubuque County, launched a new software platform called Prepared Live. The program allows its dispatchers to live stream, receive multimedia attachments, and obtain real-time location information from 911 callers' mobile devices. That could translate to quicker and more efficient response to calls for service. All emergency calls still will begin with a call to 911, at which point the dispatcher will determine if prepared live services would be useful. If the caller agrees to the service, that person then would receive a link over text message that would allow the dispatcher to begin a live video feed using the caller's cell phone camera. The Dubuque 911 Center opted to try out the first of Prepared Live's four service tiers, so the program comes at no cost to the city or county. With video feed from the scene of an incident, law enforcement and emergency services providers will get a good idea what they are facing before they even arrive on scene. Additionally, the program can instantly translate text messages in over 130 languages. The Prepared Live program already is used in several other area dispatch centers, including those in Grant and Iowa counties in Wisconsin and Jones County in Iowa. It's great to see technology brought to bear on emergency service processes. This kind of program will be beneficial to responders and citizens alike. And we have one letter to the editor. We must be mindful of the importance of civil discourse. Richard Van Eyten, Carmel Drive, Dubuque. The recent letters from Mr. Frank Potter, February 24, and Mr. Paul Kurt, March 2, are remarkable for several reasons, one of which is especially worthy of attention here. As a pair, they are especially worthy of your reader's attention in that they illustrate what might be thought of as democracy's structural dilemma as a political system designed to allow for and promote social discourse toward the end of creating and sustaining a body of laws whereby the citizens of that system might, without unjust interference by persons and/or agents of government, be free to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Free and open public discourse regarding matters relevant to carrying out the business of a democratic society, the body politic, thrives on the ability and determination of the citizens it serves to grant one another the right to be heard, and to self-impose the obligation to hear without demeaning or otherwise attempting to degrade the person or persons with whom one may disagree. It is one thing to differ with one another without being deliberately disagreeable, demeaning, or degrading. Quite another to air our differences with one unmindful of the importance of the place of civil discourse in a democratic body politic. From Mr. Kurt and Mr. Potter, we have a very candid exhibition of this fact. To differ with one another can be and often is a very good thing. Democracy cannot thrive without its benefits. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken, and I have been reading, and will continue to read, from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Friday, March 15th. And we now turn to today's obituaries. Donald C. Welsh. Donald C. Welsh of Dubuque passed away peacefully on March 12th at home. Visitation will be from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, March 17th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where a wake service will be held at 1245 p.m. A massive Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, March 18th at St. Joseph Key West Church, with Monsignor Thomas Toll officiating. Entombment will follow at Mount Olivet Cemetery with military honors by the Iowa Army National Guard and ceremony of the Four Fives by the Key West Fire Department. Donnie was born September 15th, 1933, at Mercy Hospital in Dubuque, son of Clemens O. Welsh and Regina Mary Shannon Welsh. Donnie graduated Loras Academy in 1951, began his work career before being drafted into the Army and serving in the Army in Gossenheim, Germany from 1954 to 1956. Donnie married Marjorie Ann Coakley on June 22, 1957 at St. Patrick's Church in Gary Owen. It seemed Donnie worked with his dad at Oakland Farms Dairy from the day he could walk, and he would work at the dairy until it closed in 1972. After the closing of the dairy, Donnie began a new business, a Zeebart franchise, which he operated in Key West for the next 11 years. His next position would last until he retired. Donnie went to work in the maintenance department at Findlay Hospital. Donnie enjoyed his time at Findlay, especially all the great people he would meet and develop lasting friendships with. Donnie served as a lay director at Mount Olivet Cemetery. He was a member of the Key West Volunteer Fire Department for many years and a member of the Knights of Columbus. He also served as a parish representative for the St. Vincent de Paul Society. The most important things to Donnie over his life were his faith, his family, and his friends. He loved to spend time with his children and grandchildren, attending games and events. Donnie's calendar revolved around attending any and all children's, grandchildren's events he could, whether it be baseball, basketball, football, track, golf, choir, or theater. Donnie especially loved baseball. From his time on the Prairie League field to Little League games and on to high school games. Whether it was playing or watching, he just loved baseball. The Cardinals have been his team forevermore. In recent years, he would listen to any games he could find on the radio or TV. He also loved to golf over the years with friends and with his family. Beyond family, Donnie and Margie had a great circle of lifelong friends with whom they created wonderful, lasting memories. The one thing everyone remembers when they think about Donnie is his beautiful dancing. He and Margie had so much fun dancing over the years, any chance they had. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations in Donnie's honor to the building fund at St. Joseph's Church, Key West, or to support relighting of the Centennial Cross. Jeffrey P. Birds, Putnam, Connecticut. Jeffrey Paul Birds was born in Detroit, Michigan on November 9, 1958, and died in his home in Connecticut on March 4, 2024. He is preceded in death by his father and many others. Jeff has published several books from his research in the international history of modern Russia, Ukraine, and the Soviet Union. Most currently, his work has been devoted to studies of collaboration in the German-occupied Soviet zones during World War II and the post-war Soviet counterinsurgency in Western Ukraine. This comes from him being born and raised in Dubuque, Detroit, where he attended Catholic Central High School. He received a BA from Northwestern and then attended Yale, where he received his doctorate in Russian history. After graduation, he went to Russia for 2 years to interpret the KGB archives. He was currently a professor of Russian literature at the University of Rochester in Massachusetts. Per Jeff's wishes, there will not be. Vicki M. Myers, Dyersville. Vicki M. Myers, 74, of Dyersville, passed away Tuesday, March 12th at Mercy One in Dubuque. Visitation will be held from 2 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, March 19th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue at the church home from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Wednesday prior to funeral mass. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, March 20th at St. Francis Xavier Basilica with a private burial at a later date. Vicki was born on January 3, 1950 in Appleton, Wisconsin, the daughter of Donald and Josephine Friday Kuchain. She married Marv Myers on February 13, 1971 at St. Francis Basilica in Dyersville. She grew up in Dyersville, graduated from Beckman High School in 1968. She worked on the family farm for many years. She served as manager at Raycom Credit Union, where her attention to detail was crucial. She enjoyed working with her colleagues at Raycom. When Raycom merged with Dutrack Credit Union, she served as a manager at Dutrack Credit Union until her retirement. No one to sit still unless it was on the front porch with the love of her life. Vicki took a position with Travel Dubuque after her retirement. This allowed her to spread her love of the area and her kindness to many people across eastern Iowa. She was particularly well-suited for the work because it allowed her to exercise her talent for turning strangers into friends. Vicki volunteered at Oak Crest Manor in Dyersville. It was her way of giving back to the people and place that cared for her mother. Vicki held dear the time she spent at Oak Crest and often remarked that her time spent with Oak Crest Manor residents soothed her heart and brought her so much joy. Vicki's grandchildren and great-grandchildren were always in her heart and never far from her mind. She was overjoyed when she became a great-grandmother, and she cherished the time she was able to spend with them. Vicki loved all animals. She owned many dogs and ran her own dog boarding kennel for over a decade. She spent many hours bird watching and enjoyed tracking any new species sightings. Vicki loved to read and was an enthusiastic member of the Monday Book Club at the James Kennedy Public Library. Vicki also enjoyed attending events at the Field of Dreams site. She often sat with the extended Ghost Players families by the trees. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and information is available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. Juanita J. Vanderbilt, Prairie du Chien. Juanita J. Vanderbilt, 92, of Prairie du Chien, died Wednesday, March 13th. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Prairie du Chien is assisting the family. Theodore M. DeBoer, Galena. Theodore M. DeBoer, 88, of Galena, died Wednesday, March 13th. Arrangements are pending. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Carol Rush, Carol Rush, 81, of Dubuque, passed away March 13th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 15th at Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 JFK Road, Dubuque, and from 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, March 16th at St. Paul Lutheran Church, 2025 Jackson Street, Dubuque. Funeral services will immediately follow at 10:30 a.m. at the church. Entombment will be in Linwood Cemetery. Carol was born on December 27, 1942, to Clifford and LaVon Dosser Christofferson in Caledonia, Minnesota. Carol was baptized January 17, 1943. She was confirmed April 14, 1957. Carol attended Audubon Elementary, Jefferson Middle School, and Dubuque Senior High School. She was united in marriage to her high school sweetheart, Daniel Rush, on May 12, 1962, at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church. Carol was an active Cub Scout den mother and Girl Scout leader for several years. She was a wonderful mother who raised a beautiful family. She cherished time spent with her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. In her free time, she enjoyed gardening. She was also an excellent cook. Carol was an active member of St. Paul Lutheran Church, where she taught Sunday school. She was also a member of the Aid Association for Lutherans. Memorials may be given to St. Paul Lutheran Church, Dubuque, to be put toward the organ fund. Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is entrusted with arrangements. And now for our births, we have just one. Thursday, March 14th, Filer, Aaron and Lakin Filer of Holy Cross, Iowa, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Welcome, little one, to this strange and wonderful world, really. Now we'll turn to some of our Dubuque and Tri-State news, and this lovely piece has with it a large picture of an elderly lady dressed in a beautiful blue top and a purple sweater. She's sitting in a chair at a table, and she has this look of amazement on her face, and she's holding a card. And beneath it, the caption reads, "Vera Genop is amused by a card given to her by her friend Ellen Phelps while celebrating her 103rd birthday during a special luncheon on March 8th at the Meadows in Manchester." And the piece reads, Vera Genop turned 103 March 8th, making her the oldest resident of the Meadows in Manchester. A lunch honoring her was followed by an afternoon concert performed by Daryl, Jacques, and Connie, the band that Genop requested. Letitia Timmerman, recreation director at the Meadows Assisted Living Center in Manchester, was emotional talking about Genop on her 103rd birthday. "To know Vera is to love her. She is such a woman of simplicity. She's funny. She likes jokes. She recycles cards. How many of you, with a raise of hands, have received a beautifully handmade, recycled birthday card from your friend Vera?" "About everyone here," she said, to rolling laughter from the audience. "What an ovation you deserve, my dear. An honor and a salute. You have been a blessing to all of us, and today we celebrate you." "This is too much," Genop said, closing her eyes while being honored. But it was clear she was enjoying every minute. Vera began teaching in a country school when she was just 18 and taught until 26. She married at 25 and then taught one more year before stopping shortly before giving birth to her first child. "I was a country school teacher. I got $64.50 each month, and I was tickled to death to get that money," she said. Born in Masonville, Vera Taylor married Bud Genop, and the couple raised three children, two sons and a daughter. 11 years ago, the couple moved to the Meadows. 5 years later, after more than seven decades of marriage, Bud passed away. Quick-witted, soft-hearted, and armed with an endearing sense of humor, if Genop is ever in a bad mood, few see it. You got to be positive, she assured. I had a rough start in life and had to be positive. She lost a sister at a young age from scarlet fever, and then tuberculosis took her mother when Vera was only 8. That was hard, she admits. Though her father worked to keep the rest of the family together, eventually the children were taken from him and placed in foster care, which Jeannette believes helped her develop a positive spirit. Well, what's the point of not being positive? She asked. A believer in God and the Bible, Vera said she believes her faith in God came early from her mother when she was little. Asked if she would change anything or do anything different if she had her life to do over, she thought long before answering. Well, I would let people know that I appreciated them more, she said. I had so many people over the years help me and do things for me, and did I show my appreciation like I should have? I had a foster family, and they were so good to me, and I was just a kid, and I don't think I showed them enough. And I can't now because they are gone, she sighs. You know, you just can't undo what's been done. You can't do that over again. I will wait until I am in heaven, and I will tell them then. What a message. And continuing with some more tri-state news, Republicans Lundgren and Potthoff team up for a local campaign series. Two incumbent Dubuque County Republicans, Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren and County Supervisor Harley Potthoff, kicked their re-election campaigns off with a toast at a joint constituent listening session on Thursday. The pair's event in Piasta was the first in a series of listening sessions the two have planned across the county in coming months. Should she win in November, Lundgren will serve her 5th term in the Iowa House. Potthoff is running for his 2nd 4-year term on the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors. As of Thursday night, Lundgren has a general election opponent in Democrat Carolyn Wisorek. Potthoff has no challengers so far, but said he hears a fellow Republican plans to run against him in the primary. Neither Wisorek nor the Dubuque County Democrats responded with comment on Thursday. The next Brews and Views events with Lundgren and Potthoff are at 8 p.m. April 13th at Rosie's Coffee in Epworth and at 4 p.m. May 9th at Locals in Epworth. We have one other election preview from Cuba City for the Common Council. Incumbent faces a challenger in the lone contested race. Voters will have only one contested race in the April 2nd election of Cuba City Common Council members. Incumbent Rick Hess will face challenger Ryan Gerhards in the spring election. All other open Common Council positions are uncontested races. The Telegraph Herald spoke with the candidates, and I'll just give you a bit of their background. Rick Hess, age 72, is retired. He has his wife, Ginny Hess, brother, Gary Hess, and sisters, Robin Smith and Jennifer Moore. Hess has served a partial term and one full term as an alderperson on the Cuba City Common Council and served as a city administrator in 2 Missouri towns before his retirement. And then there is Ryan Gerhards, age 35, his occupation, production line at John Deere and Dubuque Works. His wife is Sarah Gerhards. Gerhards has served on the Cuba City Volunteer Fire Department for 15 years, including as captain for 4 years, assistant chief for a combined 5 years, and chief for 2 years. He's a near lifelong resident of Cuba City and says he knows the community well. Now we'll turn to our news in brief. City of Dubuque to offer financial aid for rental unit security deposits. The City of Dubuque is offering a new program to help area residents secure housing. The Security Deposit Assistance Program, announced by the city on Thursday, provides funds to help pay security deposits on rental units for families who make under 50% of the area median income, according to a news release. It applies to any licensed rental unit in the city limits and can pay up to 2 months' rent. The one-time payments will be made by the city to the property owner directly. While it is a first-come, first-eligible program, homeless or displaced individuals are given priority. The program funding comes from a $50,000 Iowa Finance Authority grant. Applications are available at www.cityofdubuque.org/SDA or at the Dubuque Housing and Community Development Department located on the third floor of the historic Federal Building, 350 West 6th Street. The department can also be reached at 563-690-6102 for more information. Dubuque woman accused of making threats with meat cleaver. A Dubuque woman was arrested after police say she made threats against her boyfriend while wielding a meat cleaver. Kylan Kios, 27, of 2217 Woodland Drive, was arrested at 4:14 a.m. Wednesday at her residence on charges of domestic assault with use or display of a weapon, domestic abuse assault with injury, first-degree harassment, and public intoxication. Court documents state that police responded at around 2:17 a.m. Wednesday to Kios's residence after receiving a call from her boyfriend, Kasson Georgiou, 33, of the same address. Georgiou reported that Kios had been drinking earlier in the evening and was upset about several issues. At one point, documents state, Kios went to the kitchen and grabbed a meat cleaver and raised it over her head while looking at Georgiou and saying something to the effect of, "Do you want to die today?" She eventually returned the knife to the kitchen, but returned and began physically assaulting Georgiou before leaving the residence, documents state. Kios returned to the residence, as did police, who said they observed in Kios obvious signs of intoxication. Kios agreed to take a preliminary breath test at 4:10 a.m., which documents state showed a blood alcohol content level of 0.79. Police: man sexually abused teen. A Dubuque man has been arrested after police say he sexually abused a minor. Christian B.W. Dozier Sadler, 23, of 1570 Central, was arrested at 1:36 a.m. Tuesday at the Dubuque Law Enforcement Center, 770 Iowa Street, on charges of third-degree sexual abuse and dissemination and exhibition of obscene materials to a minor. Court documents state Dozier Sadler in 2021 and 2022 had sex with a girl under the age of 16 multiple times in Dubuque. Police obtained digital communications between the two from that time frame, which showed messages that were sexually explicit in nature, documents state. The abuse was reported earlier this year, documents state, at which point Dozier Sadler was contacted by local law enforcement. In an interview, documents state Dozier Sadler admitted to police officers to knowing the girl was under the age of 16 and that he kept the relationship private because he knew it would look bad. Police: intoxicated driver arrested. Police said an intoxicated driver led an officer on a pursuit in Dubuque. Donald A. Puccio, 59, of 1455 Washington Street, number 1, was arrested at 9:32 p.m. Wednesday in the area of East 15th and Jackson Streets on charges of eluding and operating while intoxicated. Court documents state that an officer attempted a traffic stop for an equipment violation at the intersection of 18th Street and Central Avenue when the vehicle drove from the area despite the officer using emergency lights and siren. The vehicle turned east off of Central onto 18th, then continued east past White Street before continuing south on Jackson Street. Vehicle eventually came to a stop in an alley between the 1400 blocks of Jackson and Washington Streets. The driver was impaired and told pursuing officer he failed to stop because he thought the squad car was a fire truck, documents state. Program details tall grass prairies. A Dubuque museum will host a program on Iowa's tall grass prairies. Museum X, Changing Landscapes, Iowa Tall Grass Prairie, Then, Now, and Where It's Going, will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, March 19th at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, 350 East 3rd Street, according to an online announcement. Cody Sharkey, the museum's conservation program manager, we'll discuss how the tall grass prairie ecosystem laid the foundation for Iowa's fertile, rich lands. Sharkey also will discuss the destruction of the tall grass prairie landscape and conservation efforts to replenish the ecosystem. The presentation will conclude with a tour of the museum's greenhouse. The cost of the program is $10. Museum members receive free admission. Dubuque Law Enforcement Center to lock lobby doors overnight. The Dubuque Law Enforcement Center is changing its open lobby policy to deter homeless individuals from sleeping there, officials said in a press release issued on Thursday. The inner lobby doors of the building will now be locked from 4:30 p.m. to 8 a.m., and the outer lobby doors adjacent to the sidewalk will be locked from 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. To access the center, located at 770 Iowa Street, after regular business hours, individuals can now use a call button and dispatch will unlock the doors, according to a news release from the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department. The decision to lock the doors is in response to individuals congregating in the lobby area and leaving trash and belongings behind, the release states. Unfortunately, over the past few months, several individuals have abused this privilege, staying here day after day, leaving their trash and personal items lying around and making citizens uncomfortable or afraid to come in to conduct business, the statement says. NICC offering courses on creating cocktails. A local community college is offering courses on creating cocktails. Northeast Iowa Community College will hold Craft Cocktails, the Art of the Perfect Cocktail, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Monday, April 15th and Monday, May 20th at Brazen Open Kitchen and Bar, 955 Washington Street, number 101, according to an online announcement. An online listing for a class in March is no longer available. The course is open to adults ages 21 and older and will be led by Brazen mixologist John Rowling. The cost of the course is $45. One possibly injured in crash from Delhi. Authorities said one person complained of possible injuries in the Delaware County crash last month. Del Rose A. Henches, 75, of Delhi, complained of possible injury, according to the Delaware County Sheriff's Department. A report states that a vehicle driven by Dorance P. Hogan, 53, of Delhi, turned right onto the roadway from a driveway in the 2400 block of 210 Avenue at approximately 10:20 a.m. February 29th. The load on the trailer Hogan was hauling became unchained and rolled over the side of the trailer and struck Hench's vehicle, which was traveling south. Library plans schedule change. Cascade. Cascade Public Library will close early on Tuesday, March 26th to celebrate the start of the construction of its new building. The library closed at 5 p.m. that day.